This is Wyman and Bob
on Seattle Sports Station, powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
Streaming live on the Seattle Sports app and at seattlesports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Dave Wyman and Bob Stelton.
Welcome, everyone. It's Wyman and Bob, Seattle Sports Station on 710. We've got Michael Bumpus sitting in with us to take the edge off of what was another Mariners loss. He's going to calm us down, Dave. We're going to try to approach this rationally, reasonably. 130 games left to play in the season, so trying not to jump off the cliff here, but a very disappointing homestand. A disappointing end to their series with the Philadelphia Phillies. They dropped 2 of 3 to them, losing today 4-2 on a day where Gilbert didn't – he had his stuff, but he didn't have his stuff. He struck out 9,
yeah,
but he gave up 4 runs in 5 innings, and he also walked 3.
I know. You know why?
Why?
He didn't come on with us.
That's exactly why.
Should have come on with us, but, yeah, I mean, this is – I mean, you're going to New York for 3, you're going to Toronto for 3, and Boston for 4. I mean, I haven't really – gone through, and we'll see how everything hashes out, but this could be the toughest road trip they have in their entire season.
Yeah,
coming up here that they're staring at. So yeah, it's kind of discouraging. Was hoping they'd be able to take that series and give them a little momentum going out on the road to the Mets, who they just came back a few games ago. They were down like 6 or 7 runs to the Phillies.
Yeah, Hombre was still complaining about that when he was on with us yesterday, but it's going to be – I mean, you're going to be facing Bassett, Scherzer, and Carrasco with the Mets, and then you get to face your old buddy Kikuchi going for the Toronto Blue Jays, because it's 3 with the Mets, 3 with the Toronto Blue Jays, and then 4 with the Boston Red Sox before they come home on May 23rd to take on the A's. So,
Bump, I'm going to have a
this
problem.
This is brutal.
I'm going to have a problem if Kikuchi comes out on fire against our offense.
Yeah, what do you expect? I mean – offense has been struggling. Days like today, I thought Logan Gilbert would take the mound and kind of even things out, right? Got himself in trouble, 2 walks, loaded the bases up, grand slam. First one given up of his career. And, just a tough homestand for these guys. Now they got to hit the road, see some good pitching. As Bob just told me, the hottest team in all of baseball right now, the Mets. Not feeling great about where this team is at, but Julio has a 6 or 7 game hitting streak. So
there's
a plus.
There's that. Yeah, they're one of they're not the hottest team, but they're in first place in their division in the National League East. They're 21-10. They've won 6 of 10. You look at the other New York team, they've won 8 of 10. The Yankees are 22-8. Not that they're playing them yet, but just looking at the hot teams. And they'll face off against the Blue Jays, who are a winning team right now, 17-15. So, yeah, you've got some tough pitchers that you're going to be facing coming up here, and this is an offense that is just struggling. They are just – you know, and Bump, Dave and I have talked about this, like, I'm tired of tipping my cap, my tiny little cap. I'm tired of tipping it to,
Well, what if you're Bumpus? You'd have to tip a huge cap.
Hey, that huge cap barely fit on your head.
All right, let the listeners know what we're talking about.
Dave, we were sitting in the sports pit, and Bump and I are both wearing hats, and Dave thought it'd be funny if we traded hats to see how they fit, and Bump, before I even touched this, he goes, I got a big head. And I said, well, I've got a very small head. So, and it worked out that way. I was swimming in his cap. It was over my eyes, and mine was just resting comfortably on top of his head, not pulled down. And then Dave put on Bump's cap, and it was a little snug.
A little tight.
So Dave's coming to the realization that all these years he thought he had a small head, he's kind of got a big head.
I don't even know how to think anymore.
Maybe the head is like the ears and the nose, you know, just slowly keeps growing over the years.
That's what you hear about. And then, you know, as you get older, certain things grow and certain things shrink. It's not a good proposition. I was going to say Bob's hat felt like a yarmulke on me.
That's exactly what it was.
Barely covering
but
my head.
It fit thumb perfectly, though. He and I have the same size head, apparently. So
pretty much same.
Did you just try to open me up to more jokes now?
No.
So now, in addition to everything else I get made fun of, I'll get the small head jokes as well. That's why I'm not wearing a hat.
I just think the funniest thing is Dave's realization that I don't have a small head. My head's big.
I got lots of hair right now. That could be it. I don't know.
He gazed off into nowhere and just contemplated life like I've been lied to my
for
whole
decades.
Life.
You know what? I almost was just going to say nothing and just turn and walk out of the building and go home.
It's just disappointed.
Yeah, but well, that's because I never noticed he had a big head. But Bump was talking up his big head, and I'm like, but when Bob put Bump's hat on, Bob could like spin his head around, and the hat would just stay in the same place.
Yeah, that's so good.
That's what we do in our off time, guys. We compare head size.
Yeah, that was show prep today.
Yeah, well, it's that or just wallow in the misery of the Mariners right now, which is. It's just not a good scene. It's a rough stretch, and I keep going back to the same thing of last year. And Bump, I don't know if I've said this to you. I think it's me telling people this to help me feel better. But you know that series that they had with the Padres last year, that rounded out a 6-game losing streak. They'd lost 11 of 14 in total, and they weren't even competitive against the Padres. And I just remember coming in and just being angry about it, just being mad, just. You're going to lose games. It's 162 games. You're going to, in a brilliant season, if you win 95 games, you win 100 games, you still lose 62 times. So that you're going to lose.
Yeah.
I get it. But when you're not competing, you're just kind of angry as a fan. Like, come on. You get beat, that's one thing. You didn't even show up. And it felt like the season was over and this team's terrible. They can't hit. They've taped together the rotation. And then look at the end of the season. They win 90 games and they're in it till the final series of the season. So I am by no means writing off this season. It just, I have a similar feeling right now that I had then.
Well, look, going into that series that you're referencing, because I do remember that being a low spot. They were 3-1. They took 3 games out of 4 against Cleveland. And then they lost 3 at home to Detroit. And then they lost the 3 you mentioned at San Diego. But they came back and took 2 out of 3 from the A's. And they swept Texas at home. Mm-hmm. For 4 games. So, you know, hopefully they can get back to that. I don't remember the runners in scoring position being as big of a problem as it is this year. You know, it seemed last year like there was lots of clutch hits and, you know, key moments. And we've seen that a couple of times this year, but yeah, for the most part. But yeah, to your point, Bob, the other thing that was weird was last year, and we'll get to this later, but the some of the calls at the plate and everything, but the thing last year, at that time, because I remember, Bob, we talked to a guy from San Diego. I think it was the play-by-play guy. And he was talking about the spider tack.
Yep.
And all that, because at that point.
Before it was a story.
Right. And I think at that point, there was like 5 no-hitters or something like that.
Two of them had been thrown against the Mariners.
Two of them against the Mariners at that point. So that was kind of the big story. And this year, it's kind of about, you know, calling pitches at the plate and everything. But no, it's funny how the baseball has a different theme of things that people are complaining about and stuff like that. But yeah, very similar to last year. And, you know, if they can have some kind of, especially on this road trip, if they're able to, let's say, take 2 out of 3 from the Mets somehow, ask me how they're going to do that. I don't know, but you know, and then, you know, they go from there to Toronto and then 4 games in Boston. So maybe if they, you know, come back with a favorable, I'll say this. I loved winning on the road. Winning on the road is, and this is, you know, maybe more of a football thing, but the cool thing about it is, and for these guys, let's say they take, you know, 2 out of 3 from the Mets and 3 out of 4 from Boston, the plane ride home, there's lots of bonding and lots of good conversation and everything. Mm-hmm. And for football, you know, when you win at home, everybody splits and goes their different way, but you know, you're on the road, you got a 3 or 4 hour flight, you know, sometimes teams will drop off into the little airport bar for a couple of quick pops before they get on, and or there are some people that smuggle bottles of vodka on the plane.
What?
I've seen that. But no, I mean, it's like a party, you know, and it's just like you kind of bond over it and everything. So winning on the road, I don't know if that's the same with Major League Baseball, but that's something that can bring your team together.
I could imagine it. I mean, what other team or sport spends as much time on the road with your team than baseball? I mean, baseball, I guess basketball has their road trips, but it's nothing like this. So I would assume if they do get that done, there would be some good times on that plane. But the thing that's keeping me optimistic still, we're still young in this season, is that the runners in score position, like they're getting guys on base, right? It's just no one's coming up clutch right now and bringing these guys in home. So there's a plus right there. And then going into this season, after talking to Service and DePoto, like we knew that 5th spot in the rotation wasn't secure, right? They didn't. They never came out and said, look, we got 5 guys ready to go right now. They always talked about who's going to be that 5th guy, who's in the minors, in the AAA, whatever, developing. So the things that we're seeing right now, one, we knew we were going to see. There's going to be a slump. And two, all right, have they found their fifth guy yet in George Kirby?
Yeah. And you know, based on that first outing, you feel, man, that's a great start. But I think we all learned a bit of a lesson from Matt Brash. His first start wasn't quite as good. He went 5 1/3. He gave up 2 runs. He walked 1, struck out 6. That's a nice start. I mean, he kept your team in the game, gives you a chance to win. For a rookie, you don't know what to expect. He's got plus stuff. I mean, he had command, and then all of a sudden that command left. I mean, he just started walking guys left and right. Each start, he had back-to-back starts where he combined 10 walks. So he just, and then it's a two-inning game. He lasts 2 innings, gives up 6 runs. And not saying this is how it's going to go for Kirby, but it's just sort of a lesson that's hanging out there. Like, all right, let's celebrate what Kirby did. That was awesome. What a debut. We all loved it. We're all there. Do we expect that each and every time? No, it's not fair to expect it. You know, hopefully he's somewhere in the neighborhood of it, just keeping the team in the game, doesn't kill the bullpen. That's what you're hoping for. Out of your fifth spot, you don't expect your fifth starter to go out there and dominate like he did.
No, and the difference between Brash and Kirby to me right now is that Kirby seems to have some command over what he's doing, right? We looked at Brash, and his stuff was filthy. That's all we're saying. Oh, it's filthy. It's not crossing the plate. It's not in the strike zone, right? He's getting guys to swing at pitches they shouldn't be swinging at. Whereas Kirby's like, all right, man, I'm going to put this one high and tight in the zone. I'm going to put this one low and away in the zone. So if there's anything that I'm comparing the two, yes, I'm still I'm staying humble as far as jumping on the Kirby train. But I look at his command, I compare it to Brash's command. I'm like, okay, he has more of a chance to sustain some success.
Well, and he's also a little bit, you know, more hybrid as far as, you know, his where he comes in the farm system. What was he ranked, 4th or 3rd or
Kirby?
Yeah, or 5th, somewhere. Anyway, Brash was a little lower.
Yeah.
But, you know, the thing you mentioned about getting guys to swing at pitches out of the zone, it just doesn't happen in Major League Baseball. After a while, I mean, some of it, you know, works for a little while, but yeah, I don't know. What do you expect from Kirby? I'm trying to look at when his next outing is, but I mean, are we going to get something that's a little bit more like Brash, or do you think? I mean, I don't see him having the similar outing to what he had as his debut, but you know, I wouldn't be surprised if he got lit up a little bit, which will be the second game against the Mets, and he'll be facing Scherzer. Yeah. How about George Kirby? You come in, you know, you got this great debut, and then you go on the road, and now you find yourself in New York with the hottest team, and you're facing Max Scherzer.
Yeah,
that's pretty awesome.
Well, the problem is with anybody who's on the hill, it doesn't matter whether it's Kirby or whether it's Marco or Gilbert or anybody, is you just don't feel like you've got any slack. You can't make a mistake. I mean, and you've got to wonder, especially with a younger guy, with Gilbert and, of course, Kirby or Brash, anybody who's younger. But even a veteran, you gotta wonder how it impacts their approach or the mentality of, do they get tight after they give up a run? Oh man, I've given up a run, or I've given up 2 runs, a 2-run home run or something. Now it, you know, you give up 3, it feels insurmountable with an offense that's functioning the way this one is, which is not well. So it puts more pressure on whoever is on the hill. Doesn't matter if it's Kirby or anybody else. You feel like you've almost got to be perfect out there, and I can't help but wonder if that does impact, you know, trying to be too fine, trying to nibble too much, and trying, you know, take away some of the aggressiveness you might otherwise have when you know, hey, this offense has my back. Yeah, I'm going to take some chances here. I'm going to go after this guy. Yeah. Maybe they're going to run into one, but I know my offense is going to be able to bail me out. You don't have that feeling, regardless of who's on the hill.
Yeah, when we've talked to pitchers, I'm sure that's in the back of their mind, but they never say it, right?
No, they'd never throw their offense under the bus. Or under the table, as Thumb likes to say.
Under the table, yeah. By the way, Scherzer, I remember that was he's the guy with the heterochromia. He's got two different colored eyes.
He's
got a blue eye and a brown eye.
Really?
That's how, you know, I was like, yeah, I remember that guy because he's always on different teams. But anyway, yeah, interesting. He is a very, very good. I just wanted to throw that out there because done talking about him.
Yeah, and it's in the news surrounding, you know, you're looking at the outfield and you're looking at Kelnick going, my goodness, this guy just, it looked like he was going to take off after that pinch hit home run, and it was such a huge moment, even though they end up losing the game. It was a massive moment. You thought, okay, now he can breathe. Now he can relax. He kind of looks the same again. He's popping up. He's missing pitches that you would otherwise. You always hear Blauer say or Goldsmith say, oh, he'd like that one back. Like, that was your pitch, and you swung and missed or you fouled it back. They're missing on their opportunities, and it's not just Kelnick, but you're seeing it with Kelnick. You're seeing Cal Raleigh go up there, and he looks like he's got no shot whatsoever. Yeah. And then you've got the underperformers, guys that have a – I mean, Winker was an all-star. He's barely batting 200 now. I mean, it's just he's slowly getting there. He's chipping in with a hit here or there, but – man, you're not getting what you thought you were getting in that trade so far. It's 32 games, I understand, but I think it's fair to question or point out, hey, man, these guys with a resume, not the young guys, but the guys that have a resume and some time in this league need to start living up to the back of that baseball card.
Yeah, with Kelnick, he's still figuring it out. I mean, he took a couple pitches late in the game today, right down the pipe, just looking at it. I mean, that's just no confidence right there. When the Mariners picked up Suarez and Winker, what's the word that was being put out there? Power. There's some power in this lineup now, and we're just not seeing it out of Winker. It's almost like he's more comfortable getting on base being walked. You know, yeah. He's not really being aggressive at the plate at times when you need him to be aggressive. I think Suarez is doing okay. He's starting to find his groove. But just like we mentioned, it's hard to rely on a lot of young guys, man. And I think when this team is struggling – and these veterans are getting it done. Now you're looking at Julio. Like, what are you going to do? You know what I mean? You're looking at Kelnick, like, save us. But these guys aren't ready for those moments yet. The one guy who seems to be stepping up and showing some real progress is Julio Rodriguez.
Yeah.
I mean, he's on a nice little hit streak right now. He's stealing bases every time that he's on. He's looking more and more comfortable in the outfield. So there are some positives there. But these power hitters need to show up because there's runners ready to score, but just not getting them in.
Eugenio, I think, has stood out. His defense has been good.
Yeah, he's kind of been, unfortunately, what he's been the past couple of years. I think we are all looking at him going, hopefully he can be that guy he was in, what was it, 18 and 19?
Yeah.
Where you look at he was hitting for 34. Average power. He wasn't kind of the all-or-nothing guy he seems to be the past couple of years. He had a shoulder injury, apparently, from falling into his pool. I still don't really know what happened there, but...
Was there not water in the pool?
I don't know. was it empty at the time? I don't know how that. But you look at him and go, okay, unfortunately, he's kind of continuing with what he's been the past couple years rather than reverting back to that guy in terms of his numbers. So he leads the team in strikeouts now. He's passed Julio and Kelnick. He's the leader in strikeouts, and that's been his knock.
Yeah.
He's played better defense than his metrics said he would. And that's been a pleasant surprise so far, and hopefully that keeps going. But the problems aren't defense right now.
Yeah.
It's at the plate, and at the plate, he feels all or nothing. Winker is giving you not much at all to cling to. Frazier is starting to find it a little bit. Those are your new acquisitions. He's starting to find it a little bit. But you look at Toro, you look at Torrens, you look at Winker in that situation. You look at basically everybody outside of France, Crawford, and Julio now, and you're looking at him as – I have no idea what to expect from him on any given day.
Well, do you fault him for the strikeouts, though? Because, I mean, that's the version you want of him. Because in 2019, he led the majors with 189 strikeouts, but he also had 49 home runs and 103 RBIs.
Yeah, what was his on-base percentage?
Yeah, it was .358.
Yeah, see, that's what I'm looking at. That's where he's coming up short. His power is there. If he makes contact, it's going to go a long way. But he's not getting on base at the clip that he did in those days. So
He's actually on pace for what, 30-plus, 30-35. What are we, 20% away through the season? He's got six home runs. So
he's kind of living up to what he's been the past couple of years, and based on what he is, your highest paid non pitcher on this team.
I don't care about the money.
Well, but I mean, it's that was part of the deal, though. You know, that was the debate, and that's how, you know, Brent and I joke around about it. But that was kind of part of the conversation when they came over. Is Winker was the guy they were going after. Suarez was the guy that the Reds, who are having a fire sale and eliminating anybody making money, well, you're taking him too because he's owed $35 million. So okay, well, they need a third baseman. He plays third base, and hopefully he can return to form. And listen, he still may do it. It's 32 games. He's got 130 games left to improve.
They need another Bash brother. You guys remember last year, there was a stretch, it was about 10 or 12 games, where Haniger and France were just going at it, man. I mean, Haniger hit a bomb. France would hit a bomb. Right now, the only power hitter that's doing his thing is Ty France right now. Now, Jamal Crawford's playing well, but he's not a power hitter, right? He's trying to put that thing in play. So you need someone to bounce it off of. I think just with Ty being that guy right now just isn't enough. But going off of what Dave said, I mean, 189 strikeouts in 2019 and 49 bombs, I'll take that.
I'd take it too. But if you look at his on base there. You know, the strikeouts you can live with if the guy's getting on base and he's driving in the runs, he's doing damage. Right now, it's so early. 6 home runs. Okay, he's leading the team. He's also leading the team in strikeouts, and his on base is not where you want it. And there have been a number of situations with runners in scoring position where he, like everybody else, not picking on him, have come up short, popped up, grounded into double plays rather than finding a way to drive somebody in. So it's a collective. It's a team effort in terms of failing to drive in runners when they're on base. And then the news isn't great because Ryan Divish wrote a story the other day about Mitch Haniger, and it sounds like he's going to be out 10 to 12 weeks.
Oh,
so you're looking at July. You're looking at July for his return. Kyle Lewis may beat him back.
That's tragic, man. And it's not because, you know, we're not going to have Mitch Haniger. To me, it's more about because, Bob, you and I have talked to that guy a couple of times. He is like a rock on that team. Mm-hmm. And this is just cruel for him. I mean, first he gets hit in the face. Then he gets hit in the, you know, the groin area. And then, you know, he gets the back thing. And then, you know, and then he gets COVID. And then, you know, this thing happens. And now you're like, oh, this guy has worked so hard. Those ridiculous workouts that he was doing in the off season. This guy just deserves to have a season where he doesn't, you know, lose any time. I really feel bad for him.
Yeah, it is brutal. And in hearing that he's going to be out, so you don't. I mean, that's sort of the early prognosis, if you will, time frame. 10 to 12 weeks is what was being said in that article.
Yeah,
maybe he heals quicker. Maybe he starts to really improve. But man, you start looking at, all right, you're not going to get him till July. That's,
hey, by the way, I don't think you and Brent Stecker, I don't think he thinks that you guys are joking around.
Yes, he does.
You better watch out.
Yes, he does. He knows we're joking around. Hopefully he does.
I'm kidding.
All right. Never a good thing if these guys are being talked about. We'll tell you who we're talking about. Coming up, it's Wyman and Bob with Michael Bumpus here. You're listening to Seattle Sports Station on 710 and seattlesports.com.
This is Seattle Sports Station.
You're listening to Wyman and Bob, brought to you by Angel of the Winds Casino Resort.
Now, here are your hosts, Dave Wyman and Bob Stelton.
It's Wyman and Bob with Michael Bumpus in studio with us, as he will be every Monday, Wednesday, and Fridays. We're not at Edgar, so he's here today talking about the Mariners, talking about umpires. By the way, this hour is brought to you by American Crawl Space and Pest Services. We've been spending a lot of time, not just us, the if you watch SportsCenter or any of the MLB Network or any of that, there's a lot of conversation going on about the umps.
Yeah,
we're 30-plus games into the season. I feel like every night there's, not just here in Seattle, not just Julio and he's getting screwed on these pitches, the Kyle Schwarber thing where he's blown up,
right.
The Madison Bumgarner thing with him holding his hand. We saw Torrens get thrown out the other night for doing nothing, but he didn't even whip the bat to the ground, and he just kind of threw it down like, ugh. And the guy who's 45 feet behind him throws him out of the game.
Yeah,
the umpires are way too present.
It's ridiculous. And you know, and I liked what Mike wrote, the tease. It's, you know, the one group of people at the ballpark that you should not notice. You are not the show. And, you know, and I heard somebody else say that I think it was a player. Was it a Mariner? It might have been. I can't remember.
I think it might have been Robbie Ray when we had him on.
Robbie Ray, he was talking about how
nobody's here to see you.
They're not here to see you, yeah, which is exactly what we were talking about the day or two before. And I was kind of surprised to hear that from him. I mean, he's absolutely right. And that's where I think the NFL, I've gotten really kind of freaked out with NFL officials when they started calling it when I remember there was a couple of penalties where somebody would scream out a expletive or whatever, and you saw, but that kind of went away.
Yeah,
you know, and so, but yeah, I felt like the umpires in the NFL were there to help you. These guys are creating an adversarial relationship with the players, and in a year, Bob, as you pointed out very many times, that this is a year where they're really seriously thinking about replacing those guys at the plate.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. You know, and they're not, as you've said, they're not doing themselves any favors at all. It's just, and today, Do you see with poor Cal Raleigh? I mean, there
and
was
Torrens.
Yeah, two pitches that were just way off the plate. He didn't react or anything because he's got a squat in front of the guy, you know, for the rest of the game. But he totally got screwed on those two pitches.
I think these umps are feeling the pressure of what do we call them? These robot umps or whatnot. And I think they're in their feelings right now. What, you got video replay now, right? Now you're questioning the umps. How dare you question the umps? This is America's pastime, right? And you look at the oldest guys on the field, they are the umpires, right? So they're the ones who are right in the middle of this, like, culture change that's going on, right, where you're being called out via social media. People have no problems calling you out there. You got video replay. You're asked to speak on your mic now and explain stuff that's happened. I think they're in the middle of this, like, what is going on here? I'm being challenged, and I don't like it. Because call it what you want. Anybody who's an umpire or a referee, you got yourself ego, just like these athletes do. Mm-hmm. And I think their ego's being attacked.
Well, and they also have an incredibly strong union, which is why Angel Hernandez still has a job. Yep. It's why Joe West had a job as long as he did. It's why C.B. Buckner has a job. They are notoriously awful at their job, yet they're not going anywhere. So they can get away with it. They can... Even in the event that they are replaced by an automated strike zone, they don't lose their job. They're still there to make every other call. It's just balls and strikes. Plays at the plate, catcher's interference, did he go around, did he not, you know, any of that. You still need the ump there for that.
It's no fun, though.
Yeah, but that's the only thing. So, if anything, I think they'd embrace it. Like, all right, fine, I'm tired of getting ripped about my strike zone. I still have my job. I'm still getting paid whatever they get paid.
Yeah.
I'm not going anywhere. They still need those people there to make every other call other than balls and strikes. It's just they have become part of the show in the worst way. You know, the Bumgarner thing was ridiculous.
Yeah,
it was absurd.
It's like he's goading him into it. Bump, you bring up a great point, and I think it's the thing about on social media. They're seeing all this. They're under attack. But they're taking it out on the players, and the players haven't really – I mean, when we talk to the players, now some of it's they're being politically correct or whatever. They don't want to, you know – anger anyone, but
they don't want to get fined.
But for the most part, you know, they are pretty understanding, and you see that they'll, you know, have a little back and forth with those guys, and you know, and you see every once in a while where there'll be a pitch called on the edge, and you know, they'll say, okay, so that's it, that's the line today or whatever, and all cordial, no problem. But yeah, I wonder if, you know, they're seeing all of this and hearing all this on Major League Baseball Network and all that maybe they're just lashing out, you know, against all of this pressure.
And let me make it clear, I'm not advocating for the umps. Like, oh, poor umpires, you guys are being attacked. Nah, I think that referees and umpires need to be held more accountable because players are held accountable constantly. You can't interact with the crowd. You can't stare down a home run. You know what I mean? Like, there's so many expectations for a player, whereas the umps and refs are just allowed to mess up and move on with their day. Mm-hmm. So they don't like being called out, and they got to get used to it, man. There's too much technology and information out there for them to just hide behind their uniform now.
Hey, guys, this is interesting. Sorry, I just saw this to kind of go along with it. The Tacoma Rainiers media relations director tweeted out about an hour ago that automated balls and strikes are starting in the PCL in 6 days. On May 17th, in an actual game, Tacoma at Sacramento, and then the first Rainiers home game after that, the 24th, they installed everything by opening day. They're going to use it. They're going to use it in a real game in
Good.
6 days.
Wow. I'll be really interested to see how it works.
Yeah.
You know, are you going to get the benefit of a call that just barely touches the edge of whatever the zone, the established zone within the machines? Well, I don't even know how these work, but, you know, how is that going to be? The one thing that I would be, I'm certain of, if it's functioning properly, that's a consistent strike zone. It's not going to vary from team to team, batter to batter. Doesn't matter if you're mad at this batter or this guy's been giving me a hard time every time we play. I call one of their games, now I'm going to let him have. No, that takes that away. So for a pitcher and a hitter, what a huge advantage to know, okay, it called it out here. That's as far out as it's going to go, and it'll be that way the entire nine. So that pitcher and that hitter, that's all they've ever said when talking about umps and their varying strike zones is like, I can live with it. Just be consistent.
Right.
You're going to call it up and away in this spot, call it that way the whole game.
Who does that help more, the pitcher or the batter, when it comes to automated or robot umps?
I think it helps the hitter because I think what it takes away and the argument against it is the ability for a catcher to frame a pitch. for him to pull it from a ball to a strike, for him to work his magic behind the plate, and if it's not crossing the zone or however this thing's going to work, doesn't matter what the catcher does. The catcher can, boom, put it over here, but the ball crossed the zone outside of the strike zone or whatever, it's not going to matter about the pitch framing.
Do you think umpires fall for that? I mean, we always talk about the framing of the pitch, and I'm like, I don't know. I guess did you hear the guy today that got hit? And he was like, gosh, bleep, bleep, bleep. You could hear him because he got hit in the arm. Yeah. But, I mean, I feel like we say, yeah, that's a nice pitch frame there, but don't they know that? I mean, they know better.
It happened so quick.
Well, but yeah, we see it in slow motion, right? We'll see the pitch. They'll show the pitch in slow motion, like, where was that? And you'll see the catcher, and it looks very deliberate, like, caught it here, moved it here. You know, but it's 98, and it's just bing.
I'd be curious. Well, I could look. Every ump behind the plate's going to go, yeah, that doesn't work on me. I know where the strike zone is. But you know,
the replay tells a different story.
Yeah, no kidding. And I think that on the broadcast, like, Goldsmith and Blowers have just stopped complaining about it, you know, and they'll just today they mentioned it because after Cal Raleigh goes down looking, it was two. There was two pitches in the same at bat. But the thing with Girardi last night and the umpire is comical to me to watch, because what it is it's two, I don't want to say grown men, they're two old men dressed up in costumes screaming at each other. Because, you know, in baseball, you're dressed up as the baseball player. I mean, if it was a NFL player, but they're in costumes.
Wouldn't you love to see screaming
and yelling at each other and putting their fingers right in the other guy's face and can't touch him, but... No. And then I think Girardi, like, accidentally touched the guy, and the guy
his finger.
Yeah. Yeah. And he did something like, hey, you just touched me.
Yeah. I'm surprised
he didn't flop.
It should be mandatory for football coaches wear uniforms. Pete should be out there in shoulder pads and wristbands and eye black and a helmet. That would be awesome.
Well, would you do the same thing for the hockey coaches, too? Because
hockey, NBA, I want them in the NBA jerseys and the shorts, the whole thing. I think it'd be awesome.
All right. The nut huggers and the tank top. That'd be good.
Coming up, we'll get Bump's thoughts and let him weigh in on what to expect from Shane Waldron in year two of running this Seahawks offense. That is coming up next. It's Wyman and Bob with Michael Bumpus. You're listening to Seattle Sports Station on 710 and the Seattle Sports app.
Wyman and Bob.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
On Seattle Sports Station.
We got Michael Bumpus in studio with us. It's Wyman and Bob. You're listening to Seattle Sports Station on 710 and seattlesports.com. Now, Shane Waldron was on with Mike Salk this morning, but you had a chance to sit down with him, Bump, and have a little conversation with him, extended conversation. What was your takeaway? What did you guys discuss?
Yeah, nice conversation. We broke down film of Drew Locke and Noah Fant, and he pretty much just walked me through some plays, not necessarily Seahawk plays, but plays from Drew Locke and Noah Fant with Denver, and pointed out some great attributes, why he thinks Noah will be a good fit and why he thinks Drew will be a good fit.
So
what were those?
Well, yeah, why? Why will they be a good fit? Let's start with Drew Locke, because tight ends, they've had good tight ends. I just don't know why they're not a bigger part of what they've done in the past. But Drew Locke, that's the most important position, the quarterback. Yeah. So why does he fit in the mind of Shane Waldron?
Yeah, he likes him because of his athletic ability. We watched film. We saw him make a throw from one hash to the other sideline, 25 yards down the field on the line. We saw him stand in the pocket when he knew he wasn't protected. He was going to get hit, stood there, threw the football. We saw him roll out the pocket, set up, have a good base, some off-balance throws. So all the things you kind of – if you were to put together a highlight, obviously because we're watching highlights, right? Mm-hmm. We're not watching Drew's worst plays. But you put together a highlight, and he can make every throw. He looks like a really good quarterback. Now, this all has to translate. He's got to get here, get comfortable, learn the offense, and perform. But the highlight tape, it look good.
No, but Dave, we talked about that. Every highlight tape, everybody looks like they're on their way to Canton. You know, you're like, oh, look at that play. Look at that tackle. Look at that sack. Look at this. Like, that's who they are every play.
Bob was asking me about that, and there was two players, and I was like, yeah, but this guy's highlights were better than that guy's highlights. So, yeah, I mean, you can tell. I think mostly it does help to look at all. But look, what else is he going to do? Show you a bunch of, oh, this is why he sucks? No, it's not. It's not going to
look at him here. What the hell was he thinking here?
But, you know, I will say this. The one thing, well, this goes more to college, but the one thing that you need to train your eyes for the highlight films from college is look at who is getting beat, or look at who's getting tackled, or look at who is getting juked. You're like, what is that guy doing? Yeah. And, you know, like I like to say, the guy's probably going to be working at Home Depot in a couple years. So, you know, that the competition there. But doing it against in the NFL, a little bit more legit as far as highlights go. I mean, as far as that goes, it's all over the board in college. You know, you could be going against a good guy or a bad guy, but if you're doing it in the NFL and you have the capability of making those plays against NFL players, that is a little bit different.
Yeah, that's the selling point is, what are they, about 1,500 players in the NFL every year around there? Yeah. I mean, there are hundreds of thousands of college athletes out there. You're right, man. I mean, it's the difference between Alabama's, like, pretty much bye week six game when they play some team that no one's ever heard of, rather than, you know, their game in the Sugar Bowl or somebody. You know what I mean? Right. So, yeah, NFL, that talent pool is so concentrated that, yeah, you can see that. So he made some plays against some NFL players. Now it's about doing that week in, week out, every snap.
Did the conversation change your – I don't know what your opinion of Drew Lock was going into that conversation, but did it change on the way out?
No. As soon as Drew Lock was signed, the first thing I did was go and watch film, right? I'm like, I don't know much about the dude. In Missouri, he killed it, I believe, 44 touchdowns 1 year. But what has he done in the league? Because the last I've heard of him, he hasn't been pretty good. So what I did was I watched film. And after watching film, I came out and I said, look, this guy can play, but he makes poor decisions sometimes. But he's also tough. He's also not scared of the moment, you know? So I could work with that. If I turned on the film and just saw turnover after turnover and him being hesitant and not being a leader, then I think I would feel poorly about him. But he's done enough to where I think he deserves a chance, and then we'll evaluate week four or five.
What as far as the tight ends go, I mean, Dave, you and I have talked about Disley every single Love year that he's been healthy. Everett, we thought, was a great addition to the team. And he was a monster. As soon as he got the ball in his hands, he was looking for people to run over. I mean, they've gone out and spent money on tight ends, whether it's Greg Olsen or Jimmy Graham. It feels like they desperately want tight ends to be a big part of what they do, but they invariably aren't. And now you've got Noah Fant, who we talked to Mark Schlereth, who watched him. He goes, yeah, he's okay. He's an athlete. You know, it was a soft sell, certainly on his end of watching him. What did you see?
I feel differently. I don't look at it and say, yeah, he's okay. He's an athlete. I look at him and say, if you can get him the ball in the space, he's going to be special. I mean, the dude can run. His routes are decent. I told him, I go, look, he's not George Kittle elusive, but you see a little bit in him. He's not Travis Kelce savvy when it comes to sitting in zones and filling the game, but you can see a little bit in him. Just enough for me to be optimistic again. Like, I don't know, who's the best Seahawk tight end, in your opinion?
Yeah, we've had that discussion. To me, I think it's Zach Miller. I think he was the most complete, and he didn't put up huge numbers here, but he did both. Also, his toughness was legendary, getting injections and everything in his foot, but he was such a good play-action pass guy. I mean, you talk about selling, yeah, and he could block, and that's what sold him is because – but the thing is, like, on a block where he's going to – he'll go all the way down to the ground and then pop up and be, you know, out on play-action pass routes. So I thought – Zach Miller, who else? What do you think? I go back to Mike Tice. Mike Tice was 6'8".
Yeah.
He owned the Fill Your Belly Deli in Redmond.
It was before him, Ron Howard?
Ron Howard, yeah, yep. I'm trying to think who else.
Have they had any standout tight ends, really, in the history of the organization?
Yeah, not really. I mean, Jimmy Graham.
Jimmy was, you look at his numbers, considering the guy blew out his patella tendon and came back. I mean, yeah. He had double-digit touchdowns. I know it wasn't at the level it was in New Orleans, but he was pretty productive.
Couldn't block at all.
No,
he was great in New Orleans. Great in the red zone. Great in the red zone. We had like 10 red zone touchdowns 1 year, I think Jimmy Graham had. But I ask you guys just to kind of wrap my head around what type of tight ends are great, right? And I look at him and I say he's not like a class A blocker, but he'll block you. He's more of a Gerald Everett to where he can run routes on the outside. He can get the football. He does a little bit of everything well. So I don't think there's going to be a big drop-off from Gerald Everett to Noah Fant.
Yeah, well, I tell you what. I think Will Disley, he's not like fleet of foot. You know, he's not going to necessarily, although, you know, when you get the ball in his hands, pretty good. But, I mean, that guy is top-notch blocker. And I think he has top-notch hands. So it's like Bob was saying, we complain quite a bit about that on this show, almost as much as defensive linemen dropping into coverage.
Well, they proved to be worthy complaints, though.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That was. And then, you know, same thing with the tight ends. Like, get him the ball, man. They both had, like, the highest catch percentage or ratio on the team.
Yeah, they keep making moves to bring them in, bringing in Everett, bringing in Olsen, bringing in Jimmy. They want those guys, but then the way they use them is always a little befuddling. All right, coming up, our guy John Morosi joins us just in time to straighten us out, make us feel better, put a positive spin on this tough stretch for your Seattle Mariners. That is coming up next. It's Wyman and Bob with Michael Bumpus in Seattle Sports Station on 710 and seattlesports.com.